It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Nonprofits throughout the Pittsburgh region are hoping you have a little left in your wallets, a little space on those credit cards after Black Friday, Small Business Saturday, and Cyber Monday. Today is Give Big Tuesday, a 24-hour online fundraiser to generate money for your favorite charitable causes throughout the region. Pittsburgh Magazine hosts this effort in conjunction with the Pittsburgh Foundation. Betsy Benson is the publisher of Pittsburgh Magazine. Good morning, Betsy.
Good morning, Kevin.
All right. So when did remind us when Pittsburgh Magazine started hosting this in conjunction with the foundation?
This is our second annual Give Big Pittsburgh. And last year we raised $1.4 million in 24 hours. Started at 12 a.m. last night and finishes up 12 a.m. tonight.
Now, you mentioned that figure. Do you ever set a goal what you would like to raise, you know, throughout the region for the nonprofits?
$1 million is our goal, as it was last year. We would love to hit $1 million. And with more than 400 nonprofits registered and the gifts coming in, you know, every few seconds there's a gift coming in on the GiveBigPittsburgh.com website. Well, we hope to reach that number by midnight tonight.
There are no matches to this?
There's $25,000 in cash and prizes. So there's a $10,000 gift from the Pittsburgh Foundation, plus an additional $4,000 from two corporate sponsors, plus more than $10,000 in in-kind prizes. So it's not matching, but all this good stuff goes into a prize pool, and we've created dozens of prizes where nonprofits can, you know, win at various points throughout the day based on various criterion, and then they have something to celebrate in addition to the gift.
So how does the single online donation platform work? Why do you think that that is, say, more efficient than urging people just to go to their favorite charities and do it directly?
Well, it's just an extremely easy, convenient, and safe way to go. All the nonprofits, more than 400 nonprofits, have all set up little profiles on this website, GiveBigPittsburgh.com. And you can just sort through them, sift through them, look for your favorite cause to see how they're making a big deal about fundraising today, how they're raising money. You can also just go directly to your favorite cause and make a simple, easy, and safe donation, and also give them the opportunity to win an extra prize. So it is, crowdsourcing at its optimum. It's a really cool website. If you go and check it out, I really recommend it. You'll see the clock where we're ticking down how many hours, minutes, and seconds till midnight. And then if you scroll down just a little bit, you'll see the leaderboards where you'll see who's raised the most money, who has the most donors, and then a scroll about recent gifts. So it's just, if you see it, it is just really turnkey. All the nonprofits on this website have been vetted with state regulations for fundraising. It's, triple safe. It's triple redundancy on security. And you can simply and easily and conveniently make a gift to more than 400 nonprofits who are registered there. You can scroll through, find your favorite cause, and make an easy gift and give those nonprofits an extra opportunity to win a prize as part of the GiveBigPittsburgh.com program.
Yeah, and you mentioned, I believe, that the nonprofits are sort of vetted to make sure that they're legit?
That's right. That's right. They're required to give certifications that are basically show that they are state. They follow the state regulations for fundraising. Every single nonprofit registered has to provide that documentation. As well, it's important to note that the gift that you make with a credit card on this site not only is secure, but it goes directly to your nonprofit's checking account. It doesn't go into any kind of holding account. It doesn't, end up anywhere else but directly with your nonprofit immediately.
You mentioned last year you exceeded the goal, and this year you're hoping to do so as well. So I guess the overall question is, does Pittsburgh give big?
That is the question. And we like to think that we are the most generous city in the country. And, you know, some of the statistics really point to that, that we have a lot more giving dollars per capita than most other cities. But this is our opportunity to have a little bit more confidence in that number and confidence in our generosity as a city. And this is a great way to measure it. How much can we give on a single day at this time of year when these dollars are so important to these nonprofits? How much money can we round up and support these nonprofits with?
You mentioned the generosity of the city. Is this situation, this coordinated effort, do you think it's unique or rare of how the city comes together in this manner?
Well, I think the recent shooting at the synagogue really underscored the fact that we do come together as a community. It was extremely touching and compelling how the community has reacted to the shooting with financial gifts. And other kinds of gifts of time as well. I think it is somewhat unique to Pittsburgh, absolutely. A lot of other cities do come together with, you know, Give Big Detroit or Give Big San Antonio. They do fundraising initiatives like ours. We would like to be able to point to ours and say, this is one of the top efforts in the country.
At the beginning, you mentioned this is the second year for Pittsburgh Magazine sort of spearheading this in conjunction with the Pittsburgh Foundation. So how does Give Big Pittsburgh maybe fit into the magazine's mission?
Well, Pittsburgh Magazine has been around for 49 years. We'll be celebrating our 50th anniversary beginning in January. And throughout all those years, if you look through the archives, we've always had close ties to the community. Remember, we were not born, but very shortly after our birth, we were part of WQED Pittsburgh. So, you know, we've always had our kind of finger on the pulse of local nonprofits, local charities, local foundations. So this is very much in keeping. We're helping nonprofits with promotion throughout the year, you know, tens of thousands of dollars worth of free advertising and support for various causes we offer. So this is just a way of saying, gee, you know, we do this and more. We also started publishing 3 years ago an annual Give Pittsburgh magazine. So we do publish a special fundraising, philanthropy-oriented magazine once a year. So this is really an outpouring of something that we have found really important for many years.
The amount that you've mentioned, I was just curious. I assume it varies from one organization, one nonprofit to another, but how much do they rely on the success of one day, a 24-hour fundraising effort?
Well, of course, the best nonprofits do fundraising all year long. So this is one day, but it's an important day. I wouldn't say it's, you know, the most important day for all nonprofits, but for some of them it is. Because think about it, these nonprofits have very limited staff, very limited resources in many cases. So for them to be able to outsource a crowdsourced website and on a day when the big spotlight is shining on nonprofits, this is an opportunity for them to get sort of free promotion around their cause that they don't have to expend their limited resources on. So it is a very meaningful, and again, it's Giving Tuesday nationally. It's a very important day for nonprofits around the country, and wherever you can layer onto that a local initiative, you're shining that spotlight even a little brighter.
You mentioned many nonprofits do fundraising over the course of the 12 months, over the course of a year. Here at WESA, of course, we ask for donations a few times a year ourselves. One measure that we look at is not so much the amount of the individual contribution, but the number of donors. How important is that for Give Big Pittsburgh?
You know, I think it's even more important than the dollar numbers, to be honest. Because, you know, a $5 gift, a $10 gift is really, really meaningful when it comes, when it basically means that a person is engaged and supporting a nonprofit depending on their means, no matter what their means are. For instance, last year, about 6,800 people donated, you know, and that added up to more than $1 million. But many of those gifts were very small. So I think engagement and education is so important as part of this. And if someone just would be willing to go on to givepittsburgh.com, go and kind of just browse through all of these nonprofits, there's something there that's going to catch their eye or maybe resonate with something personally for them. And that's the kind of education awareness that we really hope to generate through this campaign.
What do you think that the number of donors maybe tells a smaller nonprofit that doesn't have the larger, that steady pool of money to draw from?
Oh, that's a really good point. Light of Life Rescue Mission, for example, has just been, they just know how to work crowdsourcing. They plan for, I think, weeks and months and maybe through the whole year to make the most of this particular day of the year. So even though they're a very small nonprofit, they raise the most money or close to the most money. But then you have some small organizations, new organizations, like the Arcade Comedy Theater. They have, you know, now at this point in the day, have more donors than anybody else by far. So, you know, that you're showing there a lot of small gifts. And so you can rate these in many different ways. And what's so cool about this website is you can watch those numbers grow throughout the day.
And one more time, how does someone get involved with Give Big Pittsburgh?
It's so simple. Just go to givebigpittsburgh.com. And there's also links on the pittsburghmagazine.com site, but you can go directly to givebigpittsburgh.com. And what you'll see there is some background information. You can search for an organization to support. There's you can select a cause. You can search for just your particular nonprofit, or you can browse. Scroll down, and you'll see the leaderboard. You find your organization. You click on it. You make your gift with a credit card right there and then. The money goes directly to that nonprofit's banking account, and you're done. And you can decide whether you want your gift mentioned by name on the site, or you can put anonymous if you're more comfortable with that.
Betsy Benson is the publisher of Pittsburgh Magazine, which is spearheading the Give Big Pittsburgh event today in cooperation with the Pittsburgh Foundation. Betsy, thanks so much for joining us, and thanks for your great work.
Thank you, Kevin.
And you're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
It's a shame the Beatles didn't use more of George Harrison's songs, because his compositions are often considered some of the band's best.
Here comes the sun. Here comes the sun.
Another best for George? All Things Must Pass. Arguably the greatest solo album from a member of the Fab Four, All Things Must Pass cemented George's reputation as a master songwriter.
I really wanna see you.
All Things Must Pass was released on this day in 1970. For 91.3 WYEP, I'm Joey Spihar.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The debate over sprinkler systems in Pittsburgh high-rise buildings filled city council chambers last night as City Fire Chief Daryl Jones continued to advocate in favor of sprinklers for any structure over six stories or 75 feet. WESA reporter Kathleen Davis monitored that public hearing downtown. She joins me now. Kathleen, welcome to The Confluence.
Thank you for having me.
All right. You've talked to Chief Jones in the past, and Chief Jones is very much in favor of this plan, which would give property owners about 13 years to install sprinklers where they weren't in place already. But as you saw the meeting, lots of property owners aren't so keen on that idea. What's the bait? What's the debate?
Yeah, so last night there were dozens of people who spoke out against this potential legislation. Many of them were older condominium or apartment owners who lived in historic buildings, buildings that did not have sprinklers in place already. And the main argument was that this would be exorbitantly expensive for the building owners, and ultimately that cost would probably be pushed onto the residents. And many of them, who definitely skewed older, said that they were retirees, they were on fixed incomes, and there was absolutely no way that they could afford tens of thousands of dollars pushed onto them for these retrofittings.
So it was strictly a cost thing, not arguing against safety.
Right. And a lot of people acknowledged, you know, obviously we don't want to die in a fire. That would be a terrible thing to happen. But a lot of them said we would rather take that risk than, you know, potentially have to pay all of our savings for these sprinklers. One person who spoke last night was Carol Brown. She lives in the Park Mansions apartments in Oakland, and she said that retrofitting her building with sprinklers was estimated at tens of thousands of dollars per unit.
The proposed ordinance would impose unreasonable, difficult, and unnecessary costs on the cooperative owners and would certainly damage the unique architectural features of our building.
And there's also this legal argument that a few speakers brought up last night. Under state law, condominium owners are supposed to be treated the same as homeowners. So many people said, you know, why aren't single-family homes included in the sprinkler ordinance?
So our understanding is it would affect up to 430 high-rises across the city, but many of them already have the sprinklers. You were talking about Chief Jones. He cited prices from a sprinkler fitters union, saying it actually could be less costly than some have implied, including Carol, whom we just heard from. So what's motivating him here? Does he have support for his position?
So he has some support. We didn't hear a lot of it last night. But this all came to a head basically last year. There was a fire at Midtown Towers downtown last May. Several people were injured, and a 75-year-old woman died. And there was another deadly high-rise apartment fire last year in Squirrel Hill as well. Just very recently, there was a fire at Ebenezer Towers in the Hill District.
Right.
And that was contained and nobody was, there were very minor injuries, but.
And there were sprinklers there.
Yes. So there were sprinklers in the hallways. It wasn't exactly what Chief Jones is proposing with this ordinance, where every unit would also have sprinklers. But Chief Jones said this, the fact that there were sprinklers probably saved lives.
Okay. 20 seconds left. What's next? What could council do instead?
So it seemed like council was very open to what was said last night. Council President Bruce Krause said that he was going to take all these comments to heart. And there's no vote or anything scheduled right now, but we will probably hear something soon.
And they could do further study?
Yes, that's what it seems like.
Kathleen Davis is a reporter for 90.5 WESA. Kathleen, thanks so much for making the time.
Thanks for having me.
I'm Kevin Gavin, and you're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Pennsylvania is in the midst of launching its sports betting industry, becoming part of the first wave of states to do so. Sports betting only officially became legal after a U.S. Supreme Court decision in May. But Pennsylvania lawmakers were anticipating that in their search for new and more revenue that already accounted for legal sports betting in the state budget. We're going to discuss the implications of legal sports betting on professional leagues, college sports, the big casinos, and for gamblers with, in studio, we welcome John Clark, professor of sports management in the Robert Morris University School of Business. Welcome, John.
Thank you.
Also in studio is Mark Gretzky, who covered gaming trends for the Pittsburgh Tribune Review for years, now writes for Play Pennsylvania, a website covering the gambling industry statewide. Welcome, Mark.
Thank you.
And joining us on the line from Las Vegas is Jessica Wellman, an editor at Play Pennsylvania and the regional director for Catena, which operates several sites focusing on online and sports betting across the U.S., plus legal online betting sites in Europe. Hello, Jessica. And Mark Edelman is a professor of law at the City University of New York. Welcome to the program, Mark.
It's my pleasure to be here.
Okay, let's start with a reminder of the U.S. Supreme Court decision in the Murphy case, as it's called, that paved the way for legalized sports wagering in states. Mark Edelman, let's start with you. What was the reasoning for the high court's decision?
Well, the decision had nothing to do with gambling policy, and was all about the 10th Amendment of the U.S. Constitution, which relates to the anti-commandeering clause. In essence, what the Supreme Court came back and said was that it violated the rights of individual states for Congress to have passed in 1992 a law called the Professional and Amateur Sport Protection Act, in which the federal Congress had ordered states to take certain actions to disallow sports gambling.
Okay, so in Pennsylvania, what is this going to look like? You place a wager at one of the big casinos that's been approved? Mark Retzi, let's start with you on this one.
Yeah, there's five, I think, casinos in Pennsylvania that have applied for the sports betting license, and Hollywood, which is just outside of Harrisburg, opened its just a little bit over a week ago. Mm-hmm. And I assume that they will all have sports books where you can go in and choose your what game you want to play on, whether it'll be professional, collegiate, and you'll be able to, you know, bet on the games. There'll be lines as to, you know, the scoring lines and all of those proposition bets that will be available too.
Jessica, as editor for Play Pennsylvania and looking at it from afar, what's your assessment of what this is going to look like in Pennsylvania?
You know, I think we're only seeing the beginning of it so far, because what we're seeing in New Jersey and in other states that have a bit of a head start on Pennsylvania when it comes to sports betting is that the mobile betting component of this is going to be the biggest part of the whole industry. So right now, like Mark said, we have Hollywood with what we call a retail sports book where you can go to Grantville and bet in the casino. Early next year, we're going to start seeing the ability for people to download an app on their phone, load it up with a couple $100s, and they can make very small bets on their phone. They could bet $5 on the over in the Steelers game or $2 on the Eagles to win. And that's going to be the majority of where this industry is going to be once it gets going and matures a little bit.
So a follow-up, people are not going to have to physically go to the casinos themselves?
Now, that I cannot say for sure. The regulations are still temporary in Pennsylvania, and so it could go one of two ways. In Nevada, in order to load up a sports betting app, you do have to go to the physical sports book, show an ID, prove who you are. In New Jersey, the way they've set it up is actually they have enough technology to be able to use your social security number and a couple other pieces of evidence to verify who you are. And within limits, you can, without ever going to the casino, get your app up and running. You're not going to put $50,000 on it, but if you want to put $200-$300 on it, that's something that should be pretty easy to do.
Okay, John Clark.
At least even past the first visit, hopefully.
Mm-hmm. John Clark.
Well, and continuing on that point, the leagues and the teams want the ability for fans to be able to bet in stadium.
In stadium,
because it will make an otherwise kind of boring game more interesting. Now the question is, what will they be able to bet on? Is it who's going to have the first penalty in a football game, or what player is going to be injured, or something like that? And the leagues are going to be very careful about the amount and actually what will be bet upon.
Mark Retzi.
Yep. As Jessica said, the online component of this is enormous. That's the thing that will make sports betting as popular as that's the only way that sports betting is going to get the revenue that has been projected. And the ability to make bets in game is going to be the thing that really drives this. And Pennsylvania has legalized online gaming, but it is not in effect yet. So that'll probably launch early next year.
Mark Edelman, as the lawyer, are there some legal questions about these, what we would call side bets, not just on the outcome of the game?
First and foremost, with the striking down of the Professional and Amateur Sport Protection Act, there no longer seems to be any legislation that prevents states from legalizing this, which leaves two layers to look at. One, which is a very complex question under the WIRE Act, as to whether technically if there are interstate compacts between to, for example, allow Pennsylvania and New Jersey people to play in the same contest, and whether you're going across state lines, whether that could still lead to some type of federal challenge, which, as a practical matter, I believe the answer to that is no. Secondly, now that we are being regulated at the state level, we need to make sure that the companies that are providing these contests are complying with the very technical and specific rules that the states choose to put in place, which in many instances are required paying large licensing fees. There also is the very real chance that we could see a new generation of cases in which problem gamblers may try to sue online gaming operators as well as the state, perhaps arguing based on limited studies that are out there that the online gambling creates a opportunity or a situation where someone who has pathological gambling addiction is less likely to be detected and more likely to fall back into these patterns.
Okay. So will the legalized sports gambling, do you think that's going to open it up to more people who maybe didn't want to do it the old-fashioned way, even illegally? Jessica, we'll start with you.
From what we've seen, the people that are going to be new to this market are those people that the idea of having an illegal bookie or an offshore website is not appealing to them. But the idea of gambling in a regulated marketplace with consumer protections is. Where I do think you're going to see some difficulty in Pennsylvania is a big part of developing the market is persuading people who were using and are still using these illegal offshore means to bet. Will Pennsylvania be able to incentivize enough to get them to switch over because the licensing fee is higher than any other state for sports betting? Additionally, the tax rate on the casinos is higher than any other state for sports betting, which means they don't have as much money to play around with, which generally means the sports books are not going to have the best lines and the best promotions.
Mark Gretzky.
Yeah, I wanted to echo what Jessica just said, because the $10 million application fee and that 36% tax rate reduces the margin, the profit margin for the casinos. And that gets into, you know, promotions like coming, you know, you make this bet, you get another, you get a couple bucks off on your next bet, that sort of thing. So it might limit what sort of offers players get from that.
And again, I look at this from a league perspective and from a team perspective, where they're hoping that the increased ease of placing a bet will enhance interest in their contest. And you know, the brief or the cursory studies that I've done and looked at on the subject, I think the people who already bet on sport are going to continue to bet on sport. And I don't necessarily think it's going to bring droves of new people into the sport to bet.
Okay, so a question about the payoffs. Will it be more lucrative to do it with the bookie, to do it offshore, than do it legally? So will the payoffs be smaller if you're doing it legally? Mark?
I don't know if they would be smaller.
Because of the cuts that the state will take or whatever.
Right.
But safer, right? I mean, safer is the big thing.
Yes, that's it. I mean, you have player protections built in. I mean, you know you're going to get paid, and you're going to get paid on time through a licensed operator. Mm-hmm. But, you know, if the illegal operators are able to offer better odds than your hometown casino, then, you know, some people are not going to switch. And Jessica can check me on this, but what they're seeing in New Jersey is that they've gotten in quite a few new bettors into the sports betting realm. Mm-hmm.
Jessica?
They have. Mark is correct. Especially in New Jersey, FanDuel and DraftKings, which if you watched football at all two seasons ago, I'm sure you are familiar with those names and their commercials, actually now operate sports books. And that's where we're seeing a lot of new customers come in, people on the daily fantasy sports side of things coming in and playing. And what's interesting is that these sports books, FanDuel and DraftKings especially, are offering on what's called the VIG, which is the amount of money the casino charges to process this bet, where it doesn't get paid back to you. It's kind of a processing fee of sorts. They will make it a little bit bigger or a little bit smaller depending on some algorithms, as opposed to the standard, what's called a 10-cent line, where 10 cents on every dollar comes out for the book. And because these people aren't sports bettors and they aren't line shopping and they aren't professional bettors, the ease of being able to do it on your phone, do it with a brand that you know, is more appealing than losing a couple cents on the dollar.
All right, Jessica. We're going to continue our conversation about the launch of legalized sports gambling in Pennsylvania when the Confluence continues on 90.5 WESA. We're talking about the launch of legalized sports gambling in Pennsylvania on the Confluence. So, very briefly, any projections on what kind of revenue might be generated from this? Mark Gretzky, we'll start with you.
Yeah, there are, and these are all national projections that I've seen so far. But there was a conference out in Las Vegas in October called the Global Gaming Expo, where sports betting was the primary topic there. And there was a company called H2 Gaming Capital that makes gambling projections for investors and for the industry. And they're saying that sports betting in the U.S. will top the current leader, worldwide leader, which is the United Kingdom. And it will get to $4.9 billion by the year 2023.
Okay.
That's assuming that there's a whole bunch of states that get involved in it, particularly
right.
California, which there's a lot of back and forth there.
Okay. I mentioned earlier that Pennsylvania state lawmakers were sort of counting on the legalized sports gambling. Lottery proceeds, as we know in Pennsylvania, benefit programs for senior citizens. Is there a designated beneficiary for the state's cut from the gambling, or is it the money just going into the big operations pot?
The state gaming control board says that 34% of the gross gaming revenue goes to the state, and 34% will go into the general fund, which can be used for anything,
right.
And then there's another 2% that goes for projects that benefit
okay.
the public good
okay.
across the state.
Which,
okay.
Don't
ahead,
be surprised John. If those come back and somehow find their way to sport franchises in stadiums or other improvements to things
okay.
like that.
Okay, I want to get.
I mean, on that note, if you guys haven't seen in Pittsburgh, there is a letter that was publicly circulated by the president of the Pittsburgh Pirates.
Correct.
It was interesting to me, and I think it's so pertinent here, because as is Major League Baseball and the NBA with claiming an intellectual property right over statistics, which is really a rubbish argument legally. It's been defeated in the courts many times over. The argument that was being made by the Pittsburgh Pirates CEO and president was a lot more straightforward. It didn't purport any legal rights. It just came back and said, you guys are benefiting from what we're doing, and you already build public stadiums. You've already built one for the Pirates, and you've already built one for the Phillies, and we've come to you for money before, and we've raised tax money before. And this is a very easy way to raise tax money for that. So I think it's very likely that if Major League Baseball isn't able to pressure on some dubious claim of intellectual property rights, which really is a bad legal claim, they'll at least be able to use the public policy and seize some money that way for stadium maintenance.
Well, Mark Edelman, a quick follow-up. The likelihood of that, have you seen this from any other individual teams, whether it's across the nation or in Pennsylvania? The Phillies, for example.
Well, if we come off this for a moment, on the league-wide level, there is a bill percolating in Indiana to legalize sports gaming that would give a share of all the revenue derived directly to the sports leagues overall. There are several bills percolating in New York. One of them would create the same thing, a quarter of a percent of all revenue to go to the sports leagues. Which in itself is completely dubious. They claim to own the intellectual property rights over sports gaming and claim they're licensing it, which First, that's never how it's operated in Nevada. Second, we have a U.S. Court of Appeals from the Second Circuit case, Motorola v. Statrax from the late 1990s, that says that's absolutely not the case. At present, the Pirate's Letter is the only one publicly available, which I am aware of, that directly makes the request of funding to teams. But I do not think it'll be in long order before we see others. If we look at the building of the Marlins Stadium, that was raised almost exclusively through tourist tax dollars. And if you keep in mind the reality of how any tax dollar works, there's an opportunity cost. It's not free money. If the tourist tax had not gone towards the stadium, it would have gone towards another need. So I think we will see a lot more of this in the very short future.
Okay, we have just a couple minutes left. I want to get to some other questions. The impact on the sports leagues themselves. Have our professional sports leagues had a change of heart or maybe a change of bottom line when it comes to their position on legalized gambling? We'll start with you, John Clark.
I think they're just being realistic in terms of trying to save their leagues and trying to keep that 18 to 35-year-old male audience kind of vibrant in their fan base. They certainly have walked away from the uncertainty of outcome fears that they have heretofore had about gambling and gambling's involvement in sport.
Jessica, your take on the relationship between leagues and the sports gaming industry.
I think that the leagues are learning that asking for a percentage of, they're not even asking for revenue, they're asking for a percentage of handle, which is money bet, is simply not practical. There's lots of reasons, regulatory reasons that they can't. But what we are seeing is that these private deals can be very lucrative. The American Gaming Association released several studies that showed each league could make upwards of $2 billion to $4 billion off of sports betting. In fact, today, this afternoon, Major League Baseball has an announcement, and I wouldn't be surprised if it's a partnership with MGM or another casino company like many other leagues have. That's where they're going to get the money from, and that's where they're going to benefit from sports betting.
Mark Gretzky.
And there are other avenues for the leagues to make money. One is media rights. Broadcast networks pay the leagues for the right to air games, and there's going to be more interest as betting increases, and then apparel and ticket revenue.
Okay. 15 seconds for each of you. What are your projections, expectations for growth, for change? Mark Edelman, we'll start with you. 15 seconds, please.
The big change will be coming when you get sports gambling online. It's coming to most states, and it will continue to spread outward from New Jersey, with Pennsylvania being next.
All right, Jessica, very briefly, please.
I think Pennsylvania's high sports betting tax has a lot of people concerned, but given how well casinos have performed with similarly high taxes, I expect PA to be a market that rivals New Jersey in size.
John Clark.
I think how quickly leagues and teams can get the online betting in stadium will be the big thing.
And finally, Mark.
Yes, the addition of online is going to be huge, and I think sports betting is just going to increase interest in sports overall.
All right. Mark Gretzky writes for Play Pennsylvania, a website covering the gambling industry statewide. John Clark is a professor of sports management at Robert Morris University. Jessica Wellman is an editor at Play Pennsylvania and is also regional director for Katina. And also in studio, on the line is Mark Edelman, a professor of law at the City University of New York. Thanks to all of you for joining us today.
Thanks, Kevin.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. On our next program, Lessons Learned from Trying to Lure Amazon to Pittsburgh, a sit-down with Allegheny County Executive Rich Fitzgerald. Was the application process worth it? Where did Pittsburgh come up short? And moving ahead on other projects. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski. Production assistance from Meg Fair and Mick Stanelli. The producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.